Give yourselves a pat on the back, you hardy souls, for making it at 9 o'clock. Well done, well done. There's a bunch of spare handouts there should you need it. Let me just contextualize this lecture on Dangerous Age with what we are saying a little bit yesterday. So yesterday when we started looking at Newt Hampson, well, we not started, we did look at Newt Hampson, we made two or three suggestions. Firstly, we looked at the specificity of Northern modernism or Scandinavian modernism and asked ourselves the question, which we didn't fully answer yesterday, partly because I wanted to carry on the question into today, is how, given that Scandinavia hitherto hadn't featured on our mapping of the European novel, how is it that it's in the northern fringes of Europe that the modernist twist or the breakthrough happens? And again, I want to kind of come back to that question today. Secondly, the specific nature of Norwegian or Scandinavian modernism we were looking at yesterday, which had to do with the refocusing of the novelistic attention on the medium itself, which is to say language, right? So a language becomes not just the medium of information, but the part of the problem that the novel is wrestling with. And we also, by looking at some of the paintings and excerpts from the theater, etc., that flourishes in Scandinavia from 1880 onwards, we realized that this particular attention on the medium itself as a problem and the subject of art was not only confined to the novel form, but also obtained in the cases of painting. For example, we looked at Edvard Munch, theater, etc. So it was a kind of arts-wide movement, but questioning the very basis of the possibility of art. And then we looked in some details, not a lot of details, at the novel itself, and looked at how the narrator or the hunger artist, why is it that hunger or deprivation, self-willed in the novel, becomes an apt way of exploring these problems in Northern modernism. So today, a lot of those themes will spill over in our Danish text, Karen Michaelis's Dangerous Age. There will be one key difference, though, and I'll look at that in a little bit when I talk about a particular kind of architectural and art form that flourishes in Denmark over the time Michaelis is writing, called vitalism. And we'll look at two or three examples of vitalism and see how Michaelis is in many ways is writing against that particular trend. So the first thing to notice about Karen Michaelis's book, and we looked at this when we looked at Hampson again, is how much of a nearly disproportionate impact it had internationally. So Michaelis's own novel was translated into 20-odd languages, and established writers from the more recognized parts of the Western European literary scene, such as Colette, wrote to Michaelis, but also declared in public that if it were not for your books, I could not have written mine. Now, this is more, I think, a matter not just of one writer's tribute to another, but it points to a particular internationalization of the novel form, whereby influences, dialogues, cross-hatchings are proliferating across the scene. One of the things that Graham was talking about a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, are the routes that connected, for example, Dostoevsky to Dickens, etc. And we are talking about how novel form, at the same moment where it's being exported, read more and more across the world, it also becomes a form that reflects on that process of globalization, of worlding more and more. So there's a peculiar tendency in the novel form that as it circulates across the world with greater velocity, it also becomes a form that becomes more and more able to reflect on what that form of circulation means. So typically, the novel form will quite often talk about the process of being a cultural commodity in the modern world itself as at the same time, it itself becomes one of those commodities that goes around. So Colette, when she reads Michaelis and attributes a lot of her own insights to Michaelis, she's, of course, paying the tribute that one author pays to another in terms of influence. But also, it speaks to a certain moment in the history of the novel form whereby its internationalization or globalization speaks of an increasingly speeded up world where influences, ideas, etc. are now being connected between disparate parts of the globe. Of course, here the example of Scandinavian modernism becomes important. We have looked at various kinds of forms and styles before, going back to the epistolary novel, the historical novel, the realist novel, the sentimental novel, the novel of ideas, finally the naturalist novel. And one of the things we've noticed over time is that they seem to sprout out, quite often sprout up in unexpected quarters. So suddenly Russia, which is this kind of nominally backward, czarist, feudal state at the time when England is always already an advanced industrial society, or France is already an advanced imperial and industrial society. In Russia, suddenly you find Dostoevsky emerging with this unique style of psychological realism that hadn't come up in the other, in the more expected quarters of the world, if you like. How does Russia suddenly produce this advanced form that fuses together various kinds of idiom, despite it being, in some senses, peripheral to Europe? It's on the edges of Europe. Suddenly, out of Russia comes Dostoevsky, Gogol, Tolstoy, etc. So one of the patterns, if we can impose any patterns on the formation of the novel genre across the world, that we have tended to, we might venture to recognize, is that the novel, the torques and the changes in the novel form, where realism changes into naturalism, naturalism changes into modernism, quite often those hinges and clicks in the shifts in the form itself spring up in from unexpected quarters. Suddenly, Norway and Denmark, perched on the edges of the continent in more than one sense, economically, culturally, etc., produce a Knut Hamsun, or a Karen Michaelis, or an Ibsen, or a Strindberg, who completely break all the molds that were hitherto available to the more established countries and writers. So it's a kind of puzzle that we need to wrestle through when we are thinking of, going back to the title of the module, The European Novel. What are we talking about? Are we talking about an expanding, ever-expanding sense of Europe? Are we talking about a whole trend whereby certain sections of the continent, quite peripheral, marginal, in a kind of minority, usually received in a kind of minoritarian language, suddenly they, from there springs these avant-garde novel forms like the one we saw yesterday and like the one we're going to look at today. So Colette's attribute to Michaelis is, of course, as I say, an individual tribute to an extraordinary writer, but it also speaks of a kind of, I guess, a map of influence that we tend to bypass. When we think about, if you think of the kind of older studies of the rise of the novel, they tend to focus on England, on France, with some exceptions on Germany. But as Colette's attribute shows, if you take modernism as a phenomenon, modernism becomes possible only when writers of the fringes of Europe, such as Michaelis and Hamsun, take center stage. And one of the things we're going to ask is why. You'll see the same thing when we talk about the Icelandic novel with the Atom Station, or indeed with the Italian novel with Lampedusa next week. So keep that pattern in mind. From the margins of Europe springs the more advanced forms of the, or I say advanced, and this is a kind of crude way of putting it, let us say the more avant-garde forms of writing. Now, yesterday we saw Georg Brandes, the Scandinavian critic of the 1880s, declare Norwegian literature and culture of the fin de siècle, of the end of the century, as a breakthrough moment. That's the point when the breakthrough in Norwegian, but also, as we were suggesting yesterday, in European modernism happens. A similar kind of term is used for Danish modernism over the more or less the same period. The two decades following the turn of the century have been described by Danish critic Bo Haken Jorgensen as the skig zone, a gray area. In Danish literature, while a single trend, movement, or zeitgeist does not define the first two decades of the century, many competing and concurrent trends came into play. Naturalism, realism, symbolism, romanticism, social orientation, psychological introspection. So it's an interesting difference. Whereas the Norwegian modernism of Ibsen, Strindberg, Hamsun, etc., are seen as a categorical breakthrough moment. This is where the past is left behind and the future arrives. The Danish literary historians think of more or less the same period, 1880 to 1920, as a gray zone. It's not quite a clean breakthrough, but it's a gray. Why is it gray? Because of the generic mixture that you see all coexisting at the same time, where a single trend or movement or zeitgeist does not define the first two decades of the century, many competing and concurrent trends come into play. So it's an interesting moment where in the conventional European literary history, we've been talking about succession of styles. So very kind of mechanically, and this is not really a sophisticated model, but if you think of the module so far, epistolary novel, historical novel, sentimental novel, realist novel, naturalist novel. We've seen a kind of succession of styles. There's a chronological logic to it. One comes after the other. In Denmark, in 1880 to 1920, the suggestion is all those styles coexist. They're happening within the same time. So realism, naturalism, symbolism, romanticism, social orientation, psychological introspection, etc., are all bunched together, and they're jostling against each other. I'm going to have to grab a handout because not all the quotations are on there. Now, this makes for an interesting situation. So what you have here is not a neat succession of stylistic or artistic trends, but a moment which is very fertile because all these things exist next to each other. And because of that fertility and because of that of the complexity of the situation, it's impossible to designate it either as a kind of clean break from the past, etc. In other words, the whole formation of Danish modernism is a much more complicated affair than it appears to be in, let us say, France or England, where that particular jostling of styles happened over a more elongated period. What has happened in terms of literary history over, let us say, 100 years in France and England is happening in 20 years in Denmark. All those movements are coexisting rather than following each other. And that becomes important when we look at someone like Michaelis and the particular style as well as the topic that she chooses. So two things to remember in the beginning. First, that Danish modernism is an international phenomenon. It exerts a kind of disproportionate influence on Europe, the rest of Europe and rest of the world in terms of literary history. Writers pay their tributes to these extraordinary, I say Danish modernism, let's just generalize it to Nordic modernism for the moment. Pay tribute to this extraordinary crop of writers and artists who appear in 1880 and 1920. Second, there's a sense of perplexity as to how to categorize that moment. Is it a moment of breakthrough when literary history is left behind? Is it a moment of a coexistence of all these different modes and style out of which this unique voice of the novelists or the unique eye of the artists and the sculptors are formed. So that's to contextualize both the impact of Northern or Nordic modernism and to point out the specifics and the differences between Danish and Norwegian modernism, one designated as an area of breakthrough, the other as the skeg zone or the gray area. The second point is to move into continuing with something that we have looked at before about Nordic modernism, its turn inward into language itself. As we were talking yesterday with Hamsun and the hunger artist, language becomes both the subject and the medium of the novel. In Denmark, you see a similar trend, and you see this mostly obviously in the work of the philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Now, how many of you have attempted to engage with Kierkegaard? Good. Because it's not the kind of thing you want to do to yourself in early morning, right? So Kierkegaard, as a philosopher, is also a biblical scholar. And what disturbs him most, or energizes him most, about the nature of biblical scholarship is the, again, something we were talking about yesterday via Maud Ehlman's analysis of what hunger means or hunger art means, is the gap between rhetoric and meaning. The gap between, if you remember yesterday, we were talking about Maud Ehlman's analysis of the IRA hunger strikers, where what they were talking about, i.e. demand for the new prison, civilian clothes in prison and the status of political prisonership, etc., imprisonment, and what they were actually doing, which is starving themselves to death, that's an extraordinary gap between language and deed. Because, as Ehlman asks, who would want to starve themselves just for a new set of clothes? So clearly, there's a gap in the case of the art of hunger between what is being proposed and what is being acted out. And that gap, as we talked about yesterday, ultimately points to the nature of language itself, the gap between what language is and what we take it to be, and the actions, the social actions organized around language. So the rules of society, the rules of grammar, the rules of food, the rules of money, etc. Kierkegaard has a very similar and proves to be a very influential thinker in Denmark and in the Nordic countries in general with his examination of the gap between the language of the Bible and the actions and the meanings of those actions in the Bible. In particular, he fixates on the incident of Abraham's covenant with God. If you remember that episode in the Bible where Abraham is instructed to sacrifice his own son as a test of his faith. And what Kierkegaard, partly because he's quite a gloomy man and he likes the story of the near sacrifice of the son, etc., and partly because this illustrates for me, for him, a fundamental paradox about language, which is to say, a covenant defines, this is a biblical story, of course, defines faith as a willingness to sacrifice slash murder one's own son, but it defies all standard codes. Not just ethical, but familial, tribal, and lingual. Here is a story one has thought one understood, but the Danish philosopher is at pains. This is Arnold Weinstein's book, which is on your handout, and we talked a little bit about it yesterday, about Northern Arts. A Danish philosopher is at pains to show how fraudulent our knowledge is, how unspeakable these matters are, since they resist both logic and language. What Kierkegaard is saying, we take these stories as commonplace, because we kind of, you know, we think, and this is towards the tail end of biblical scholarship in 19th century, where the Bible is now taken as a historical rather than a supernatural document, largely because of the labors of the German romanticists and grammarians. What Kierkegaard is saying, these stories are now available to us, and we read them in various ways, as parables, as fairy tales, as religious articles, etc., etc. But do we actually get what this means? This is a story that says faith is about the readiness to sacrifice physically in flesh the dearest and the nearest person in the community, your child. Do we actually get what that meaning of that terrible act is. How is it that faith in divinity, is defined as an act that transgresses all established social codes? Which social code, after all, demands the killing of your children? Which social code even, or what kind of society even has a language to describe that phenomenon? Those are the questions that disturb Kierkegaard. So what he talks about is we think our knowledge is based on this whole universe of stories that are available to us through language, but quite often the stories that come down to us defy all norms, social norms, and understood consensus about what language ought to be like. So there's that gap that haunts him between what the language tells us and what those actions actually mean. That's Kierkegaard, is one of his more cheerful moods. What I am to do, not what I am to know. That extract, if you can read, says, what I really lack is to be clear in my mind what I am to do, not what I am to know. So there's that, again, that gap between how you know and what you do that appears, and he goes on to be wax lyrical about God, etc. So I bring up Kierkegaard here as an example of the mood of Danish modernism or Nordic modernism. What is being tested out here is a proposition that knowledge is available via language. That proposition is being tested out. What is being proposed is a much more disturbing connotation, which is to say all knowledge is contingent on the arbitrary nature of language. There's nothing natural or given about any of our social laws, linguistic, economic, sexual, etc. So that this is a moment when Nordic modernism establishes that, of course, there are kind of in various art forms, novels, paintings, etc. Of course, there's the human subject. Of course, there's a story about society, etc. But perhaps fundamentally, what all art forms should deal with is testing out the possibilities of its own medium. Can language, can meaning be communicated socially via language? What are the limits of that? How far can we go with that? Can we look at a painting and understand what that topic is, what the subject is, unless we also train our thoughts and our eyes on how the painting is done, how it, in a way, explodes itself, right? It turns itself inside out and presents itself to you, to the viewer. So that emerges as one of the fundamental problems that Nordic modernism presents to the world, and this will be taken up, of course, if you think of the later canonical modernist texts, Joyce, Beckett, Proust, etc. This idea of representability becomes the point of those works. These are works that constantly question the possibility of their own fiction. If I tell you a story, how stable is that code of meaning that that is being transmitted to you? At one of its extreme, as in this novel, Michaelis's novel, which is a series of epistles and diary entries, what Elsie Lindner, what the narrator will constantly question is the possibility of transmitting that meaning. Quite often she'll say, nothing can be known between one man and another. Nothing can be known between a woman and a man. If men only knew what went on in a woman's head after 40, she would be put down like a mad dog, she says, right? Now, that is partly to do with the biological framework there, a woman after 40, which we'll come back to when we talk about the modern body. But it's partly to do with the possibility of language itself. Can you actually know each other? Right? Or are we caught in this kind of black hole where our own structures of meaning confine us rather than release us into society? So that becomes what, I mean, Kierkegaard admittedly is one, if you like, an extreme example of this meditation. But as a movement, Nordic modernism focuses on the limits and possibilities of language itself. And this, of course, as you can see, is reflected in the critics, in the various critics' reception of Michaelis. From the first page of her letters and diaries to the last, she challenges herself and her readers unrelentingly, without intervention by any other narrator, about the politics of women's aging. We'll come back to the importance of the politics of women's aging in a bit. Die Entfernliche Olde dispenses with the conventional narrator who foresees and analyzes a character's development. And of course, that itself is a part of the point here. This is a novel that dispenses with the notion of development, character development. One of the things that often irritates and challenges readers is Elsie's fluctuations, right? You start by saying, I have broken free of all marriages and bonds of love. I am an enlightened being now. Lo and behold, 30 pages into the novel, you say, Jorge Malmsteen is the only man I've ever loved. And, you know, I'm inviting him back to my house, etc. Oh, lo and behold, he's rejected me. Back I go with my maid and off into this kind of, you know, Latin American trip. It's, you know, as far as existential crises goes, it's not that bad if you can go off to Latin America or Africa, wherever it is, every time you have a crisis. But that inconsistency, which often irritates readers, come on, make your mind up, we say, is partly to do with the politics of the aging woman's body. We'll come back to the body question because we looked at one particular kind of body yesterday. But it also comes back to the whole possibility of language itself. Can Elsie ever know herself if the only medium of her knowledge is language? No wonder if language is, as Newt Hampson's narrator proposed to us yesterday, is this arbitrary, slithery, a disruptive medium that constantly shifts meaning. No wonder the possibility of knowing yourself recedes the more you immerse yourself in language. Right? Elsie writes all these eruptive confessional moments, but what is the only tool she has to do this? It's language. Therefore, she can't fix herself at any point in the narrative. She changes her mind, she contradicts herself, she leaves, she stays, she falls in love, she falls out of love, etc., etc. So one of the things that Michaelis absorbs from that particular moment of Nordic modernism is the instability of linguistic meaning itself, and related to it, of course, the instability of her idea of her own self. The problem for Elsie is, the diagnostic language she has for her condition is one of insanity or madness. She can't make up her mind. She's a hysteric middle-aged woman. Her body is shutting down. Her entire sense of who she is, etc., it's changing, etc. So she constantly, and we have seen this before, right from Raskolnikov onwards. In fact, why stop at Raskolnikov? Right from Stendhal and Julien Sorel onwards, or even all the way back to Goethe's hero. The idea of insanity becomes the available diagnostic tool, right? I can't speak in straight sentences. My language doesn't make sense to others. The other people run away when I talk to them or scream at them, etc. What am I? I'm insane. That's the language they have. But the part of the point that the novels are making, that is this really insane behavior? Or is this an insight into the arbitrary and the unstable nature of language itself? Sanity and insanity is often, the dividing line is often the category of linguistic competence. If I don't make any sense to you, not just over this 50 minutes, but for the rest of your university career, you'll go, lecturer A is just completely mad. I don't understand a word of what he's saying, right? So that idea of linguistic competence, which is to say, communication, becomes a dividing line between madness and its opposite, the state of normalcy. What all these narrators flirt with, and some of them given to entirely, is the idea that they're struggling with this idea that they themselves might be mad, but in the process, in some ways, they reveal the madness of the system itself. the madness of the linguistic system itself, the madness of the social system that attributes all these stable meanings to various actions, the madness of systems of domination such as patriarchy, et cetera, that Michaelis is particularly interested in. So through their madness, we glimpse a more general madness that grips society, that is smuggled under the title of sanity. So one of the things they question via their own very lacerating self-examination is to what extent the society they inhabit can be characterized as sane. Elsie Lindner, of course, Michaelis's own narrator, makes a similar kind of gesture to the hunger artist insofar as she says no to the systems of meaning that construct society. So Annegret Heitmann, this is on your handout as well, speaking about what Elsie's actually doing, says, the double movement of negation and conquest can most clearly be seen in the domain of language. Here too, a no can be heard. Remember that passage we were talking about yesterday in the lecture where the hunger artist is said to have said no to not only food, not only money, but to dictionary itself, i.e. to meaning itself. A part of his art is a provocation that refuses all the systems of meaning. Similarly, Elsie here does exactly the same through the way she presents her own self in her various epistles and diaries. Here too, a no can be heard, a refusal to be content with the existing structures of language on the grounds that they are always an expression of existing social structures. A counter language has to be created, in short, écriture féminine. Women's language, a counter language has to be found. And that language, by definition, it has to be disruptive. Because what you're saying no to is not just established narrative codes, but what they mean. Established narrative codes give us a chain of meaning that holds society together. And historically, that way of holding society together has been one of the ways of holding the society together has been via patriarchy, which is not just a system of actions, but a system of meanings, right? A system of assumptions, what women should be like, what men should. The thing about patriarchy we often forget is it is as prescriptive about men as it is about women, right? It describes masculinities as well as femininities. So when we're talking about women's writing or feminism and feminist consciousness, one of the things that we should try and do is to weigh up both those sides and weigh up the damages those prescribed gender roles do to women and men, of course with the difference that historically patriarchy has tended to privilege certain sections of men over others and over other women. So when we're talking about the challenge to patriarchy, as Michaelis does, all she has is language. How will she say no to the language of the fathers? Yes, by disrupting the narrative. Yes, by disrupting literary forms. But the no goes, it's not just a negative gesture. In breaking, if you like, in the kind of old language of Marx, it's creative destruction. You destroy a convention, but in doing so, you're building another form of writing, écriture féminine, the writing of, for, by women. And that by nature is disruptive. It doesn't mean that writing is only done by women. For example, think of Ibsen in A Doll's House, which could also be argued is an example of écriture féminine in the fact that it explodes all those rules of fathers and husbands that bound houses together. But by its very nature, this gesture of saying no is also a gesture of saying yes to another kind of language, which is necessarily disruptive. So the second point about Danish modernism, and in fact Nordic modernism, is that in turning its attention to language itself, it also turns its attention to the social institutions that language supports, one of which is patriarchy. It also proposes, via writers like Michaelis, that that analysis of language and society gives rise to a new, much more dislocated, a much more disruptive form of linguistic and artistic representation. This is a writing that's marked by ellipses. This is a writing that's marked by disjunctions, discontinuities, a narrator who doesn't know herself, a narrator who's never at peace with herself because she's struggling with the inheritance of language she herself has had, which encodes within it fatherly laws. So in the beginning, she says, Richard and I are divorced, but I don't know why. I don't have, when she says, I don't know why, what she's really saying is, I don't have a language to express why I've divorced Richard. We're not having an affair, he's not having an affair, we are the conventional married couple. Why have we separated? That phenomenon, that urge to separate, has no language for Elsie. All she can say is, I don't know. But throughout the novel, what she does is, she turns that I don't know, that state of unknowing, into a form of art. She's constantly disrupting and dislocating her own stable positions. So the second point about Danish modernism or Nordic modernism is this discovery of a language of disruption, which becomes a suitable form of exploring a moment when conventions are being challenged and reexamined. The third and the final point today, I'll close over the next 5 or 10 minutes, is this, that modernism, so far, we've described as more or less in a radical register. So yesterday when we were talking about the hunger artist, and today when we are talking about Karen Michaelis's, what we're saying is this moment when formal literary and artistic conventions are exploded, new forms are invented, new forms that are by definition disruptive to our notions of language, propriety, sanity, insanity, marriage, sexuality, etc., etc. So more or less we are saying this is a radical moment where these conventions are challenged. But modernism as an art form is not always radical, right? There's a radical strand that goes through it. There's also a more conservative form of modernism that goes through that particular mode. And Danish vitalism, which also flourishes, as you can see, 1890 to 1940, roughly over this time that Karen Michaelis is writing, might be an example of conservative modernism that talks about the purity of the body as a counterpoint to what Michaelis is doing. So the point in discussing this is Michaelis doesn't only inhabit an artistic or literary universe where form breaking or boundary challenging is the norm. She's also inhabiting a moment when a rearticulation of the beauty of forms, ancient forms, etc., have also become popular, especially so in Denmark, via vitalism. What is vitalism? So in other words, as an artist, she's struggling against both, or struggling with, both this kind of radical inheritance of modernism, but also conservative context where her very topic, a woman's body under duress of menopause, the moment where her hormones have changed to an extent that her whole idea of her being a reproductive agent is under duress, is under challenge. That particularly turbulent moment, description of a body that's hysteric, which is how Elsie Lindner talks about herself, is invented next to this current in Danish art, which talks about not the hysteric body, not the body under duress, not the body in extremis, not the body being starved, but the body triumphant. So particularly influential trend in Danish art and architecture is embodied in Rudolf Tegner, the architect's massive sculpture, which I will see in a bit, The Arch of Life, which he makes between 1912 and 1915, Tegner is very straightforward about what the responsibility of the modern architect and artist should be, a hymn to the life of human beings from birth to death, rendered in stone and bronze, etc., wanted to express their joys and sorrows, their loves and separations, their struggles, victories, defeats, until solitude takes each in its embrace, and this is what he comes up with. That is Arch of Life. Now, as you can see, this is populated by these. These figures are not very clear, but I'll show you another scripture. The making of Tegner's architecture is neoclassicist. It goes back. It harks back, as you can see, both in its topic and in the shape of the arch and the figures that populate them. It consciously gestures back to classical Greece and Rome, and the form of the human body that, although might be dying in some instances. There you have Perseus fighting one of the many monsters he fights. The form of the human body actually declares the beauty and the supremacy of the human form. That's the classic neoclassical heroic male body. Okay. The same thing can be seen in that final frieze of Tegner's The Triumph of Life. These are bodies beautifully sculpted, beautifully presented as human forms triumph over the universe. And by doing so, they consciously echo what they take to be the splendors of classical Greece and Rome. Of course, vitalism got a bad name in the first part of the 20th century precisely because that fed so easily into the various radical right-wing movements of the first half of the 20th century, most obviously, of course, in the Nazi cult about the perfect body. So vitalism becomes very important to the Nazi hymn to the body, of particular kind, of course, the human body triumphant over history. That we see, for example, in Leni Riefenstahl's very early documentary about the Berlin Olympics, 1936, where the focus of Riefenstahl's magnificent film, it has to be said, in terms of technique, sings a triumph just like Tegner does to the form of the human body. So no hysteria here, no menopause, certainly, no body in decay, no madness. This is a statement of, this is a modernist statement that talks about the triumph of the human body over time and history, okay? Exactly contrary to that, you have Elsie Lindner. This is a body, as I said, that's hysterical, that's always puts herself under erasure, that always questions its own viability. So the final point of your two final passages in your handout, the first to gesture to the fact that the idea of cleanliness, hygiene, and the vital body is not confined to Danish architecture, but to Danish society as a whole. I've just given you a letter from the Danish Association Against the Legalization of Immorality, a women's association that campaigned against prostitution, and they're declaring their mission statement. What does it say of a homemaker's sense of cleanliness if she allows the worst of the filth to pile up in heaps in the cellar of the house because it seems loathsome to her, etc.? So you'll notice the conjunction between femininity, homemaking, and cleanliness there, right? The duty, this women's organization, of every of every woman is to not only ensure her own personal bodily cleanliness, but the social cleanliness around her, which is under threat from prostitution, etc. So there's a very easy equation that you might call vitalist in spirit that makes that is made between a woman's body, perfectibility, cleanliness, social cohesion. All these orders, all these categories are, of course, exactly what is exploded by Michaelis by making the menopausal woman her central character. So your final extract on the handout, most disturbing to contemporary readers of Den Verleger Older, was its depiction of menopause, a topic suppressed even when studies of human sexuality were becoming conventional in modernist narratives and in Scandinavian literature in general. Rather than identifying their problems as the onset of decline, she presents women's, quote, hysteria as a symptom of women's character in flux and struggling to reposition the sexual desire that had been killed by her marriage, etc. So what you have here is Michaelis writing or struggling against one dominant form that modernism takes in the Nordic countries, the spirit of vitalism and the worship of the body. Which has, of course, certain implications for a woman's role in society, i.e. the women's body must be perfect, must be clean, must be homely, must be against impurities of all form. Against that, Michaelis, a part of Michaelis's no, which is partly linguistic, is also to reject the biological imperatives that come with that language of perfectibility of women's bodies. Instead, she presents a heroine who is menopausal, who is emotionally all over the place, who's reassessing her own life in terms of what does her desire mean? What does it mean to desire beyond the prescribed age of desire? Right? How do you accommodate that feeling? How do you find a language to say that, that the moment Michaelis is writing, that language is not available? There is no space, linguistic or artistic, that breaks the shackles of the normative idea of what a desirable woman is and should be, and gives her a language to describe her desire that contradicts those normative notions of desirability and reproduction, i.e. what happens to a woman's body when it's gone beyond its reproductive cycle and is still desiring. There is no language for Michaelis or in modernism to describe that at that moment. So what does Elsie do? She says no to her available languages of the fathers that she's working with, but in order to say no, in order to invent this new language, she has to invent a language of disruption, of discontinuity, and of ellipses, which is why she gives us the series of letters and diary entries which present her essentially through her own eyes as a woman whose subjectivity is never completed. There is no Bildungsroman here. It's an anti-Bildungsroman cycle. There is no development. But maybe, just maybe, it is in that gesture of saying no that modernism and feminism coalesce in a gesture of saying yes, which will look to the future of both women, but of language as well. So, there you go, Nordic modernism. We'll talk next week about a very different kind of modernism, south of Spain, and then we'll Graham, in the final two lectures, which is to say the leopard, in the final two lectures, Graham will round back on Icelandic and Hungarian novels, and we'll end with a discussion of the module as such in the final week. Well done for turning up. Go and get a coffee.